My friend Tawny Plattis lost her husband and podcasting partner this past November. You may already know Tawny through their amazing comedy history podcast called The Dirty Bits. But now, Tawny is channeling her grief into her creative comedic talents. I lost my mother 2 weeks ago, and when I discovered that Tawny, aka the Witty Widow, was launching a new podcast on how to deal with grief through comedy, I thought, wow, my mom would have loved this. My mother was a widow for 28 years. And though she suffered, she laughed. A lot. She was known for her beautiful laugh and mischievous giggles. I'm about to play a promo for Tawny's new podcast, Death is Hilarious with the Witty Widow. I know I will be tuning in as I cope with the loss of my mom. Because as my hero Dolly said in Steel Magnolias, laughter through tears is my favorite emotion. Check it out, y'all.
My husband just died. Recent, right? Or yep, you're making jokes about it.
Hi, I'm Tawny Plattis, the Witty Widow and creator of the new podcast feed, Death is Hilarious. When my husband and fellow creator of the Dirty Bits podcast passed away in November of 2019, I immediately fell into writing and comedy as a way to cope. Now, I'm traveling around the country to interview your favorite podcasters and artists on how they found relief from grief on my new show, The Witty Widow. The podcast is slated for release in 2020. Tune in for bonus shows now, like Monday Morning Maisel, where you can join Midge Maisel and me as we cope with the loss of our spouses and learn lessons about moving through grief with comedy. And stay tuned for next week's premiere episode of Entertaining Grief, a series where I talk about how watching and relating to movies and shows has been helping me gain perspective on and cope with the death of my husband. Search Death is Hilarious in your favorite podcast listening app or visit tawnyvoice.com/podcast to subscribe and listen in.
We're going to make it through this show. We're not going to get over this show, but we're going to make it through this show together.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Hide it in the hiding place where no one ever goes. Put it in the pantry with your cupcakes. It's a little secret, just the Robinson's affair. Most of all, you've got to hide it from the kids. Those were lines from the classic Simon and Garfunkel song, Mrs. Robinson, immortalized in the equally classic film, The Graduate. The Graduate is about an older woman seducing an aimless young man who had recently graduated from college. In today's episode, we also have an affair between a 20-year-old man in college with a 37-year-old woman during the summer of 1975. He was a swim coach at the Jackson Country Club in Jackson, Mississippi, where she and her family were members. When her husband found out, Harriet Robinson immediately ended the affair. Her spurned lover, John Alexander, a student at Vanderbilt University, went back to school in Nashville after the affair ended, but returned to Jackson in early October, still obsessed with Harriet Robinson. Soon, his obsession turned into simmering anger and rage. Rage that would destroy several lives. Welcome to episode 79. Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Starting the episode with lyrics to Mrs. Robinson is very appropriate, as you will soon find out. It isn't just a coincidence. But here are some more lyrics for you. I'm going to Jackson. I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town. That's from the Johnny Cash and June Carter version of the song Jackson. Folks argue over whether or not they meant Jackson, Tennessee or Jackson, Mississippi. Cash famously said he meant Jackson, Tennessee. But the actual songwriter, Billy Ed Wheeler, said he chose Jackson for its sharp consonants, not a specific Jackson Town. Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood reached number 14 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1967 with the same song, 6 months after Cash and Carter reached number 2 on the country charts. I like to think of the song both ways, and I found another interesting tidbit about it. It was played in the movie The Help, which is set in Jackson, Mississippi. It's still a song about the desire to cheat, about the fire going out of a marriage, which again, makes it appropriate to today's story. Either way, it's one of the many jewels in the crown of Jackson, Mississippi, a storied, gorgeous, and historic southern city. Jackson began as a settlement on the Pearl River called Lafleur's Bluff, named for a French-Canadian trader, Louis Lafleur, who had founded a trading post on the site. 4 years after Mississippi became a state, in 1821, the state legislature chose Lafleur as the new capital city due to its strategic location. Not just on the Pearl River, but fairly close to the center of the state, typical for most capital cities. Lawmakers chose to name the new capital Jackson after General Andrew Jackson, who was a national hero after defeating British forces at the Battle of New Orleans, the final battle of the War of 1812. The governor's mansion, completed in 1842, majestically designed in the Greek Revival style, is the second oldest continuously occupied governor's residence in the United States. Virginia's is 29 years older. The Magnolia State also lays claim as one of the founding states of the blues, a musical style from the Deep South, claimed by many different states. In 2006, the Mississippi Blues Trail was established to educate the public about this unique and quintessential American art form. Though it is American, the blues has roots in African musical traditions like work songs, spirituals, field hollers, and ballads brought to this country by enslaved Africans. 189 historic markers are spread out over the state of Mississippi, with each sign planted at a locale that played some role in shaping the blues genre. Jackson is home to 13 markers. Jackson is also home to two Pulitzer Prize winners, author Eudora Welty for the novel The Optimist's Daughter, and playwright Beth Henley, who wrote Crimes of the Heart, and more recently, modern author Catherine Stockett, who wrote the 2009 bestseller The Help, is also from Jackson. As illustrated in The Help, the state has an ongoing issue with racism. As journalist Jasmine Ward wrote in 2018, it's built into the very bones of Mississippi. Civil rights activist, World War II veteran, and secretary for the NAACP, Medgar Evers, was assassinated in Jackson in 1963. Eudora Welty's short story, Where Is This Voice Coming From?, is written in the voice of Evers' assassin. Bob Dylan wrote Only a Pawn in Their Game about Evers' assassination. And Nina Simone wrote and sang Mississippi Goddamn about the Evers case. The home of Medgar and Merle Evers is now a historic museum in Jackson, and the International Airport in Jackson was renamed Jackson Medgar Wiley Evers International Airport in January 2005. But despite the city's attempt at healing, it still has a race problem. This past August, a Mississippi sheriff made a racist remark in a text message that went public. So while many modern Mississippians consider themselves well beyond the ugly racist past, it still lingers, especially in the more poor districts, where African Americans are not properly represented in law enforcement or local government. Jackson, Mississippi in 1975 was obviously still feeling the effects of the civil rights movement and slowly making changes. But it was still a wealthy college town, home to the most colleges in the state, with Jackson State University being the largest. It also often hosts the annual Egg Bowl, the football rivalry between Ole Miss and Mississippi State that goes back to 1903. Many white Jacksonians in the 70s were prosperous. Mrs. Harriet Robinson, though married to a prominent businessman, was a public school teacher. And her lover, in the summer of 1975, was the son of another prominent businessman and high school teacher. Their fateful meeting at the Jackson Country Club would not only devastate both of their families, but was one of the biggest scandals to hit Jackson's elite since 1966, when Mississippi was forced to end prohibition, 33 years after the federal law was overturned by President Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression. He reportedly remarked, I think this would be a good time for a beer. But Mississippi was slow to change in so many ways and decided to uphold prohibition. Mississippi had actually outlawed liquor a decade before the 18th Amendment banning it was passed. and Mississippi lawmakers didn't see any reason to change that. That is, until Hinds County Sheriff Tom Shelton led a raid at the Jackson Country Club in 1966, where among many private citizens, the governor of Mississippi was celebrating Mardi Gras with illegal liquor. Jackson is the county seat of Hinds County, along with being the state capital. Today, there are still 36 dry counties out of 82 in Mississippi. Not exactly surprising when you consider that Mississippi is practically the buckle of the Bible Belt. It should also come as no surprise that according to the Magnolia State's Alcohol and Beverage Commission, moonshine is still produced or available in literally every county in Mississippi. Incidentally, Jackson is both a wet and dry city because it lies mostly in Hinds County, where liquor is legal, but also partly in Rankin County, where liquor sales are still illegal. And on that note, fix yourself a drink, whether it's an iced tea or something stronger, and I'll be right back. Harriet Virginia Metz Robinson was born in Oxford, Mississippi on August 22, 1937, to parents the Reverend Dewey Robinson and his wife Jeanette. She was the youngest of four children. Her brother Dewey Jr. was 17 years older than her, and her brother George was 14 years older. Her closest sibling in age was her sister Weta, who was 6 years older than her. So Harriet was the baby of the family. And she grew up to be a lovely young woman, athletic, brunette, petite, and was often named prettiest or most beautiful in yearbooks. Harriet spent much of her early life in Memphis, Tennessee. She graduated from Whitehaven High School in Memphis before attending the private liberal arts college Blue Mountain College near Tupelo, Mississippi. She then transferred to Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, to earn her undergraduate degree. Harriet was named in the Who's Who section of Union University's yearbook in 1959. As basketball maid, strawberry queen, and campus beauty of 1956 and 57. She was active in physical education and performed in many plays and was in the chorus. She then moved back to Oxford, Mississippi and got her master's degree in special education from the University of Mississippi in 1962. Suffice it to say, young Harriet Metz was not only beautiful, but intelligent, hardworking, and community-oriented, and she was always involved in the church. Raised by a reverend, it's easy to see why Harriet's faith was very important to her. She soon got a job teaching special education in the Jackson Public School District. She met John Robinson and married him in January of 1964. John Robinson Jr. was 7 years older than Harriet. Born in September of 1930, to parents John Sr. and Lucy Enox Robinson in Jackson, Mississippi. He graduated from Central High School in Jackson before also getting his degree from the University of Mississippi in 1952, 10 years before his wife. He served in the Air Force as a pilot instructor for 5 years, and his obituary states that he served in the Mississippi National Guard for 19 years. Like his wife, John was civic-minded and also devoted to the church. He and Harriet were members of the St. Andrew's Episcopal Cathedral in Jackson, and their children would attend private school there. The Robinsons had 3 children, John III, born August 19, 1964, about 8 months after his parents married. You can do the math. Then daughter Harriet Enox Robinson was born in 1966. And their youngest was born in 1971, a girl named Margaret Virginia. Maybe it's the Southerner in me, but I love that their children all have family names. It's rare to see a girl take her mother's first name, but as Harriet's son took his father's name, I think it's lovely that she named her first daughter after herself. They also used John's mother's maiden name, Enox, for daughter Harriet's middle name. And Margaret was given Virginia, her mother's middle name, for her own middle name. The Robinsons appeared to have a happy marriage. Obviously, we can't know their inner thoughts and private struggles, but they were a popular couple in the community and prosperous, sending their children to private school, And of course, they were members of the Jackson Country Club. By this time, John was vice president of his firm, Robinson, Julian, and Bailey Insurance. And yet Harriet still chose to work. That may not sound strange to modern women, but this was the late 60s and early 70s in a very conservative community. It wouldn't have been at all unusual for Harriet to have become a housewife. But she was devoted to teaching and very active in her community. In fact, she was still involved in community theater, playing one of Cinderella's evil stepsisters in a local 1974 production. Harriet was featured often in the Clarion Ledger, Jackson's top newspaper, for ladies' cotillions, charity functions, and even modeling and fashion shows. Always a popular and stunning woman. Her children were active and regularly made the papers for their accomplishments. I found one article on Harriet Robinson Jr. winning an award for her backstroke at the Jackson Country Club for the Briarwood swim team. Because she had her mother's name, I almost mistook this for Mrs. Robinson, who was also a staple at the club. In fact, in the summer of 1975, she met a young swim coach at Jackson Country Club where her daughter swam. His name was John Peyton Alexander. He was 20 years old and a student at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. His parents, James and Elizabeth, had been members of the Jackson Country Club for years, but ended their membership due to financial problems in 1971. James Alexander, a World War II Navy vet, worked as a real estate developer, and his wife Elizabeth was a chemistry teacher at Callaway High School in Jackson. Court records show that in 1975, James Alexander was close to bankruptcy, despite being regarded as wealthy with a high social standing. John also later said his father was a drunk, who was physically and emotionally abusive to his mother. So John Alexander, no longer a member of a club that he had been for many years, was working there during the summers as a swim coach. Just 4 years earlier, he would have been swimming in that pool as a member. I can only imagine the class resentment issues this may have caused him. He also supplemented this income by being a swimming and diving coach at the local YMCA. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he worked there because he still wanted to be a member again one day. He was also a high-achieving young man. Born December 30th, 1954, John graduated from Murrah High School in Jackson before receiving a math scholarship to attend Vanderbilt University. He had three sisters named Patricia, Mary, and Elizabeth. From what I can tell, Mary was the oldest, and John was in the middle of Patricia and Elizabeth. I've seen his name listed as John Peyton Alexander II and found that super confusing because his father's name is James, but he's actually named for his grandfather. Later in life, he would attempt to go by Peyton, and there is some crap now about him changing his name to John Apple. John Alexander would pull many shenanigans later in life, after his affair with Mrs. Robinson, and after he went to prison for her murder. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. Some people have trouble falling asleep. Some have trouble staying asleep. Personally, I have trouble with both. I've been an insomniac for years, and it only seems to get worse with age. And on average, people are getting less quality sleep than ever before, so I'm not alone. Tackling sleep issues can feel impossible because many sleep aids aren't effective for both needs and make you feel too groggy in the morning. That's why I was so thankful to find Rimrise. Rimrise is a personalized sleep solution that uses natural, plant-based formulas to help calm the mind, relax the body, and get your circadian rhythm back on track for better, more restorative sleep. And it's drug-free with no groggy side effects. All you have to do is go to getrimrise.com/southernfried and take their free sleep quiz. I took their quiz in minutes. It was easy, and I quickly found that I needed the Rise and Shine formula, which calms and clears your mind while cooling your body so you can fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up feeling rested. Do what I did and check out Rimrise Rimrise today. Go to getrimrise.com/southernfried, take their sleep quiz, and when you sign up, you'll get your first week of Rimrise for free. You just pay for the shipping. You won't find another offer like this anywhere else. Get your first week of Rimrise for free when you sign up at getrimrise.com/southernfried. That's getrimrise.com/southernfried. One of my favorite parts about the holidays is reconnecting with family, especially those we only get to see at the holidays because we live far apart. We swap stories and laugh, reliving those moments together. But keeping those memories alive can be hard. That's why I'm giving my family a really meaningful gift this year, StoryWorth. It's an online service that helps your loved ones tell the story of their lives through thought-provoking questions about their memories. StoryWorth helps capture those memories and preserve them forever. With weekly emailed questions, you never think to ask, like, what have been some of your life's greatest surprises? And at the end of the year, they will get these stories and uploaded pictures bound in a beautiful keepsake book that is shipped for free. StoryWorth is a wonderful gift for the holidays, something special that cannot be bought in any store. I gave my mother StoryWorth this past Mother's Day. So for Christmas this year, I decided to give it to my best friend Stephanie. She is the keeper of stories and photos for our little family of friends, and I cannot wait to see the finished book next year. Preserve and pass on memories with StoryWorth, the most meaningful gift for your family. Sign up today by going to StoryWorth.com/southernfried. You'll get $20 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/southernfried for $20 off. Harriet Robinson and John Alexander met in the summer of 1975 at the Jackson Country Club. Specific records never say, but it's possible he was Harriet Jr.'s coach. Mrs. Robinson was an avid tennis player, and she took her children to the club often in the summer. So it's also possible they just met by happenstance. However it happened, 37-year-old Harriet and 20-year-old John began a passionate affair. Court documents say that over the course of their summer romance, they lavished gifts on each other, sent each other love letters, took drives in the country, and even a short trip to Florida together. When the summer was over, John returned to Vanderbilt, where Harriet reportedly called him frequently. As much as their affair will later seem like a one-sided obsession, Harriet did seem to be in love with John. It was more than a summer dalliance. However, John Robinson found out about the affair in September of 1975. How, I am not sure. John Alexander would later claim to friends that Harriet told her husband. Mr. Robinson called John Alexander at Vanderbilt and told him to stay away from his wife on September 28, 1975. John Alexander later claimed in court testimony that this call from Harriet's husband included threats and that he feared for his life. His mother later claimed that he slept with a shotgun between his mattress and box springs because he was afraid John Robinson would kill him. I don't doubt John Robinson made threats. I do doubt that John Alexander actually feared for his life, as you'll soon see. Harriet Robinson immediately broke off the relationship with John Alexander. As with so many affairs, the heat of passion grows cold when a husband or wife finds out. John Alexander became despondent. He was so depressed, he visited a school psychologist at Vanderbilt. Friends later said he even spoke of suicide. Not long after, he dropped out of school and went to visit his sister and some friends in New Orleans. But he soon returned to Jackson and moved in with his mother. According to court documents, this was for her safety, as he insisted his father was an abusive alcoholic. Their marriage had deteriorated further during his bankruptcy when his company, Parham Bridges, went under. John Alexander worked odd jobs for a while before he decided to reapply for his old position as swim coach at the Jackson Country Club. This is the moment when everything went sideways. Yes. John Alexander was obsessed, but John Robinson was now out for vengeance. John Robinson, with Harriet's signature, circulated a petition among the country club members that John Alexander was incompetent for the job as swim coach. So John Alexander moved on to another country club, applying for a similar position at the River Hills Club. But according to court documents, John Robinson was friendly with several board members at River Hills. So John Alexander, once again, did not get the job. Now he was angry. He had already been hurt. He had been obsessed with Harriet, listening to the Simon and Garfunkel song Mrs. Robinson repeatedly over those months. But this was different. John Robinson was using his own wealth and social status to stop Alexander from getting a job. I am in no way excusing what John Alexander would later do, but there is a part of me that sympathizes with the notion that here is this college kid who got into an affair way over his head. His parents were on the brink of divorce and in bankruptcy, and he was barred from finding work because of his ex-lover's husband. But I also sympathize with John Robinson. A broken, betrayed heart is a powerful thing. I can also understand his actions. He did not want to see his wife's young lover at his own country club. Nor could he abide him working where his friends would see him. At this point, it was an issue of honor. They were both hurting and angry, and God only knows how Harriet felt. And with what came next, I'm sure she was humiliated and embarrassed, on top of what I am sure was the enormous guilt she felt. Harriet Robinson was a pillar of the community, a school teacher with three children of her own. Her kids were young, too. John III was 11, Harriet Jr. was 9, and little Margaret was only 4. Whatever else Harriet was, she was a mother. She may have had feelings for John Alexander. Her continued calls seemed to support that. But when faced with losing her marriage, she ended the affair. And now it was all about to become really public. In retaliation to John Robinson's petition and his influence at the River Hills board, John Alexander Xeroxed copies of Harriet's love letters to him. He mailed those copies to several members of both country clubs. Specifically, he wanted these letters to show that the petition at the Jackson Country Club was not based on his incompetency, but jealousy over his affair with Harriet. But again, he was playing a game way over his head. Unfortunately, he should have taken those hits from the country club and moved on with his life. Taking the affair public did ruin all of their lives. It was egregiously vengeful. And frankly, Mr. Robinson had way more right to feeling vindictive and petty. He was the cuckold, not John Alexander. Furthermore, if John Alexander loved Harriet as much as he claimed, why would he do this to her? How would ruining her reputation save their relationship? Well, obviously it didn't. Instead, John Robinson filed a civil suit against John Alexander, demanding damages awarded. On August 6th, a Hinds County judge issued an injunction ordering Alexander to stop, quote, any acts tending to harass complainant John W. Robinson Jr. or his family, pending further order of this court. John Robinson was not playing around. He may have played dirty keeping Alexander from finding work at those clubs, but again, should Alexander have really gone back there for work? The affair was bad enough. The husband knew. Why risk it? After being turned down by two country clubs, John Alexander finally secured a position at the YMCA. By this time, his parents had divorced, remarried, and were in the process of another divorce. To say his life was strained and that he was going through some shit is an understatement. It still does not excuse his actions. In September of 1975, he bought a .380 automatic pistol and ammunition. The date will be important later due to Mississippi gun sale laws. He had also found a construction job to supplement his work at the YMCA and was still living with his mother, and still obsessing over Harriet. However, his friends thought he was doing better. They thought he was coming around and moving on. On October 3rd, 1975, he went to a birthday party for a friend at the Golden Dragon restaurant in Jackson. He reportedly left the restaurant and went home, but went back to the birthday boy's house at around 11 p.m. saying he couldn't sleep. This was a usual complaint, along with his depression. There's no doubt that John Alexander was still suffering, but his buddy and several friends got skateboards out and skated in the streets until almost dawn. These friends later reported that while John did discuss the affair with Harriet and seemed on edge, he was more angry about the job at the country club. They were used to hearing him pine after Harriet. This was a new angry John Alexander. The next morning, on October 4th, 1975, John Alexander played tennis with another friend at Battlefield Park in Jackson. Neutral territory, not the country clubs, and not where he worked. They finished their game around 11:15 that morning, and he arrived home around noon, according to his mother. He asked his mother for her checkbook. He said he wanted to buy a new tennis racket. But then he left the house and drove directly to Parham Bridges Tennis Courts in Jackson. It's ironic. The Parham Park was named for his father, James Alexander's former partner. And now, Harriet Robinson was there playing tennis with a friend. Maybe she was also avoiding the country club after the scandal, trying to let things die down. She had a tennis date with her friend Betty Lewis. Her kids were playing at the park playground nearby. She and Betty were walking towards the parking lot, chatting. Betty noticed that Harriet stared at a young man in a Toyota Corolla, but she didn't say anything. So the two women kept walking. Then John Alexander seemed to come out of nowhere. He walked right up to Harriet Robinson and shot her in the head. Betty Lewis said at first when she saw him, she didn't think anything of it. But then she realized he was moving fast towards her and Harriet, and she backed away. She saw that he had a gun pointed at Harriet. After Harriet fell to the ground from the first shot, John Alexander stood over her and fired 7 more shots into her head and neck. Some that didn't see what happened at first thought it was firecrackers, but then onlookers began to scream. It was pandemonium. People were running around and screaming for help from the Parham Bridge employees and calling for the police and ambulance. Betty Lewis, who at first ran away, ran back to her friend and then collapsed. Employees at the tennis court ran to bring towels, but it was much too late. With 8 shots to the head and neck, Harriet Robinson lay dead. Making matters worse, despite several people calling the police, it took them 20 minutes to get on scene. According to the Clarion Ledger, witnesses were actually trying to flag down police cars who ignored them. An ambulance arrived on scene 15 minutes after the shooting, 5 minutes before the police. Not that there was anything that could have been done to save Harriet. The police department later denied getting any complaints on how long it took them to get to the scene. For nearly an hour, Harriet Robinson lay in view of children and any other people at the courts that day. I pray someone grabbed her children and shielded them, but there's no way to know. They may have later seen it in the newspaper anyway. There is a front page photo of her in the Clarion Ledger, lying dead, with her head and neck covered by a white towel. But her short tennis skirt and tanned, shapely legs were on display for everyone to see. It doesn't get much more shocking and lurid. The death of a beautiful woman is always like that, but this was awful. It was horrific. Looking at this with 2019 eyes, we know you don't move a body right away. There would be crime scene technicians collecting evidence, photographing the scene, while cordoning off the area and making sure no one else could see. But in 1975, the Jackson police did not work this way. And it was terribly egregious to the citizens of Jackson that Harriet Robinson lay exposed long enough for the newspapers to get a shot at her. I'm going to pause now for a final word from our sponsors. I've done all of my holiday shopping online, which is so convenient, but it's also easy to overspend. To me, that's worse than going to the actual store and standing in line. Luckily, I use Honey. It's a free browser extension that saves you time and money with online shopping. Honey scans the internet for coupon codes and other discounts, and then magically, Honey automatically applies the best deal to your online cart at checkout. Honey scans over 20,000 sites like Target, Macy's, Domino's, and my favorite, Amazon. I just shop like I normally would and then see that lovely discount applied before I check out. It's amazing. It's like finding a 20 in your coat pocket. As usual, Amazon has been my go-to this holiday season. And on one huge order, I was delighted to see a discount of over $65. To date, Honey has found over $1 billion in savings for their 10 million users like me. Listen, there's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and installs on your computer in just 2 clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/SFTC. That's joinhoney.com/SFTC. As the holidays are upon us, life gets much busier, and it's easy to fall off track when it comes to your health, wellness, and fitness routine. Care of is here to help, making it super easy to keep track of your vitamins and other healthy habits during the holiday season. Care of delivers vitamin packets, protein, and energy powders, and more right to your door. Care of's short 5-minute quiz asks you about your health needs, your diet, and lifestyle to get your personal vitamin and supplement recommendations. Whether you're looking for glowing skin, more energy, or better sleep, Care of is there for you. It can be really hard to know which vitamins and supplements you should be taking, but Care of's easy quiz made it so easy to figure out what I really need. I love the convenience of Care of products delivered right to my door in cute individual packets with my name on them. You can modify your subscription at any time when your needs or preferences change. Care of also offers vegan and vegetarian supplements to match your dietary needs and make sure you're getting the nutrients you need for those specific diets. Care of wants to make sure what you're putting into your body comes from the best sources. Their website offers full transparency and ensure only the highest quality of products. For 50% off your first Care of order, go to takecareof.com and enter promo code SouthernFried50. That's takecareof.com and enter the promo code SouthernFried50. After John Alexander shot and killed Harriet Robinson, he got in his car and drove straight home and told his mother what he did. She told him to call the police and turn himself in, which he promptly did. So he was in police custody within an hour of Harriet's murder. He was held without bond, pending his pretrial hearing. By November 26th, a Hinds County Chancery Court grand jury convened and refused to indict John Alexander, declaring that he was insane after hearing from two psychiatrists who evaluated John while he was in the city jail. He was immediately transferred to the Whitfield State Mental Hospital for a 20-day evaluation period. His lawyer, Sebastian Moore, used a rarely cited statute that permits a grand jury to transfer cases to a chancery court in order to get the psychiatrist on record. He said his client was mentally ill and needed to be in a hospital. Chancery courts do not typically hear criminal cases. However, they do preside over sanity hearings, like when a family member wants to get a relative committed. This was an unusual move, but head prosecutor Ed Peters told reporters he was not concerned. Quote, he will return and stand trial, or else he'll stay in Whitfield until he dies. Experts pointed out that if he was released after the 20-day period, this could help the state's case in proving he was competent to stand trial. Alexander's lawyer said at the time he felt his client would be held longer than the 20-day period. But he wasn't. He was released after the 20 days and returned to the city jail. The Clarion Ledger reported it was because his lawyer learned that anything he said to the state psychiatrist might be used against him at trial. So he ordered his client not to talk to doctors. So they discharged him. And he was immediately brought before a Hinds County grand jury that did choose to indict him for murder on March 2, 1976. Even early on in the papers, you could see this was practically going to be a street fight between defense attorney Sebastian Moore and district attorney Ed Peters. The 4-day trial was reported extensively in the Clarion Ledger. The prosecution opened the trial with a short 2-minute statement of facts, and as the paper put it, Peters sat down after calling the slaying an execution. Sebastian Moore stood up and named all of the psychiatrists and witnesses he planned to call to prove that John Alexander did not know right from wrong when he shot Harriet Robinson. Word got out on the first day of trial that the prosecution had brought in their own mental health specialists. Peters told the Clarion Ledger it was because Mississippi, unlike other states, does not allow the prosecution to use their own psychiatrists to determine a defendant's mental competence. So he needed professionals to witness the testimony of Alexander's team of psychiatrists to possibly refute their findings. That older statute has since been changed, but obviously, Peters had a point here. If he was not allowed his own team to evaluate Alexander, it was only fair he had professionals evaluate the testimony of the psychiatrists hired by the defense. Sebastian Moore snidely told the paper that he didn't need to go to California to get witnesses. This was a dig at Dr. Seymour Pollack, one of the top forensic psychiatrists in the nation, who was brought in by the prosecution. This was so much drama that the doctor had to make a statement to the paper saying he could not say how much he would charge for his services. but that detail may come out at a later date. And it did. He was paid $500, a little over $2,000 in 2019 money. That's actually not a lot of money for an expert witness. The state called four witnesses who had been with John Alexander in the days leading up to the murder. That included the clerk who sold Alexander the gun 2 weeks before the murder, who said he behaved normally. So did his friend he played tennis with that morning, just an hour before he shot Harriet. He said he acted normal and was not visibly upset. Other witnesses were from the tennis court that day and a police ballistics expert who matched the bullets from Harriet's body to John's gun. The prosecution rested quickly the first day, and the defense was ready. They called six of John Alexander's friends to testify about his mental status. They all said he never talked about killing Harriet, though he did often mention suicide. These same friends said that John was so sensitive about the affair that he would shake while talking about it. All of the friends also mentioned how upset John was about his job at the country club. One friend said part of his obsession involved the lawsuit filed by the Robinson, ordering John to leave them alone. At this, John Alexander blurted out, "I wasn't bothering him," before his attorney calmed him down. Another defense witness testified that he only carried the gun around because he was afraid of John Robinson. Sebastian Moore attempted to get all of these witnesses to say they believed John Alexander was insane the day he killed Harriet. But Peters objected, and the judge agreed. Unless the witnesses were at the scene, their speculations about his mental health at the time of the murder were irrelevant. John's mother and sister Mary also testified for him. Mrs. Alexander said that he often compared his relationship with Harriet to that in the movie The Graduate, and that he listened to the Simon Garfunkel song Mrs. Robinson repeatedly. She said, quote, "John didn't know the nature or consequences of his actions. He didn't know what he was doing," she insisted. She told the court when he came home that day, he showed no emotion when he said, quote, "Mom, I just shot Harriet Robinson." The first defense psychiatrist testified that he said he felt Alexander's knowledge of right and wrong was severely impaired at the time of the shooting. The next psychiatrist was more chilling. He told the court that John Alexander told him that he had done a beautiful thing because, quote, "when she turned towards him, an instant before she was shot, she knew what was going to happen and why." This psychiatrist also claimed that Alexander felt his survival depended on eliminating Harriet Robinson from his life. He also said, quote, "I think he's crazy now in his belief of what a wonderful thing he did." On cross-examination, the doctor admitted that the tests given to John Alexander could not prove whether he knew right from wrong at the time of the murder, the legal grounds for judging insanity in Mississippi. The next psychiatrist up for the defense was Dr. Mario Panetta. He made a crucial error by reading from letters John wrote while he was in jail. Prosecutor Ed Peters jumped on this quickly. He demanded that the doctor turn over his files, including the letters. Defense attorney Sebastian Moore, of course, strongly objected to this, citing attorney-client privilege. But he was overruled. By letting Dr. Panetta read from those letters, he had entered them as evidence, and the jury had a right to hear everything in them. It was devastating to John Alexander's case, and there is no indication in the papers or court documents whether his attorneys knew and approved of the doctor reading from the letters. But they had to know they were opening that door. I can't believe they would have risked it, but I also can't believe they would put a witness on without going over his testimony. So I just don't know. I do know what the letters said, though. After a two-hour break in which Dr. Seymour Pollock had time to go over the letters, he read parts in open court and gave his opinion. This is the top forensic psychiatrist the prosecution had brought in. He read from one of John's letters, quote, "I made up my mind when I lost my job I would kill her. I knew sooner or later I would run into her, and I swore I'd get my job back or kill her if it was the last thing I ever did." He further said, quote, "I blew that bitch up because I was sensitive about money and people matters." It seems to me he was deeply angry about his parents' financial situation and their ousting from the country club. His being blocked from working there only made him angrier. He went on to say, quote, "At the time I shot her, I didn't love her. If I had, I would have kidnapped her until she decided she wouldn't have wanted to go back. But she damn sure didn't want to die." He went on to write, showing no remorse, quote, I hate to admit it, but it's true. I feel better about myself than in years and years and years. I'm just sitting in jail now, vegetating, with no pressure, no responsibilities, no need to perform. The doctor even read a letter from John Alexander to his attorney, Sebastian Moore. He said, quote, It was premeditated murder. Revenge is sweeter than life, so says the fool, and I'm the fool. Everyone seems to be on my side. That is something I didn't count on. I was shocked that this letter was allowed in, seeing as it was to his attorney and not as a doctor. I think that should have been privileged. However, the psychiatrist said he used it in his evaluation, so it was let in, and it shows John Alexander's cockiness. He thought his friends rallying around him and the battery of psychiatrists his lawyers had would save his ass. Dr. Pollack concluded by saying he believed John Alexander was sick, but quote, I believe he was also using his sickness to make him look sick enough to be legally insane. Dr. Pollack felt the letters illustrated that John Alexander did indeed know right from wrong, despite his mental illness. He said, quote, To be excused from criminal responsibility is a very special kind of crazy. Now we know that modern psychiatrists would not use that terminology. But he's also not wrong under our legal system. Prisons are filled with the mentally ill. Usually, an insanity defense is only successful when a defendant can be shown not to be able to separate fantasy from reality. Or you might think of an impulse killing. Because of the mention of Whitfield Hospital and soon Parchman Prison, I was reminded of the Ruth Thompson case, also out of Mississippi in 1948. She hacked her mother to death with gardening shears in what I believe was a momentary fit of rage after an argument. But instead of pleading insanity, she tried to blame it on an imaginary black man. It didn't work. She was convicted, but released after only 6 years. That's actually similar to what happened to John Alexander. His insanity defense did not work. The jury deliberated for just over an hour and found him guilty and sentenced him to life in prison. But he didn't go directly to Parchman. He was transferred from the Hinds County Jail back to Whitman for treatment. Sebastian Moore had made a motion before the judge after Alexander's sentence was read to have him transferred. Even if he was not insane when he murdered Harriet Robinson, the testimony of six psychiatrists showed that he was now indeed insane. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic. And once he was properly medicated, he was transferred to Parchman Prison to serve his sentence. His attorneys immediately began the appeals process. In 1978, the Mississippi Supreme Court upheld Alexander's conviction. The main point on appeal was that John's friends had not been allowed to give testimony on whether or not they thought he was insane. His attorneys also brought up the use of John's letter to his attorney used in court. But the Supreme Court found that since John turned over those letters to his doctor so he could form an opinion on his sanity, he himself waived attorney-client privilege. Also in 1978, John Robinson sued John Alexander for wrongful death in a civil suit, and he sued the store where Alexander bought the gun. To buy a handgun in the state of Mississippi, you must be 21 years of age. John Alexander was actually 20 when he bought the gun. However, on his application, he stated he was 21 and changed his year of birth. The court found that while the clerk who sold the gun was negligent in comparing Alexander's ID to the birth date he gave, quote, the act of Alexander in murdering Mrs. Robinson was an independent, intervening agency which superseded the negligence of the defendants. John Robinson did win his case against John Alexander, but I find it doubtful that he actually collected the sum $27,000 he was awarded. In August of 1984, John Alexander was paroled after serving only 7 years for Harriet's murder. John's mother had gone before the parole board and promised she would see to it that he took his medication for his diagnosis of schizophrenia. He moved to Jones County, where the sheriff there told the newspapers, quote, he hasn't been any problem. I am unsure if his mother actually lived there. Once she and James divorced, she was hard to trace. John Robinson had remarried in 1982 to a woman from Houston, Texas, named Nella Stevens. She had two daughters, Jessica, 15 years old, and Melissa, 9. They were almost the exact same ages as the Robinson girls. Harriet Jr. at that time was 15, and Margaret was 10. John III was then 17 years old. However, John Robinson passed away suddenly the next year, in April of 1983, at the age of 52. How awful to think he had found love and happiness again, only to die a year later. At least he passed away while John Alexander was still in prison. And yet, tragedy was not finished with the Robinson family. On Christmas Day, the same year that John Alexander was paroled in 1984, little Margaret Virginia, the youngest of the Robinsons, was 13 years old and visiting relatives in Springfield, Tennessee. Her obituary says she drowned in an accident. I can only imagine the despair and guilt of the family she was visiting. Her obituary also lists her mother as Nella and all of her siblings, including her stepsisters, but does not refer to her birth mother, Harriet, or her father, John Robinson, in the place where an obituary would normally name those who preceded her in death. However, it does say she was survived by her grandfather, the Reverend Dewey Metz. He would have been 82 years old and had to endure the death of his beloved youngest daughter and now his young granddaughter. I will make no inference at her parents' names left out of young Margaret's obituary. I don't like to think or believe it was malicious in any way. In times of great pain, people often let others handle these affairs. Nella was clearly still raising Margaret and Harriet Jr., though John III would have been 18 and presumably in college by then. John III went on to become a lawyer in civil litigation and lives in Ridgeland, Mississippi. I could not find as much information about Harriet Jr. except for school yearbooks on Ancestry.com. Like her mother, she was a pretty girl, though blonde rather than brunette when she was younger. Also like her mother, she was high-achieving and athletic, playing basketball, volleyball, and she was also a cheerleader. I can only hope that she is living a happy and private life today. Unfortunately, John Alexander came back into the Robinsons' lives in 1995. He had quit taking his medication, actually as far back as 1986, when his own father, James, had him arrested for assault. Reportedly, he had struck his sister Patricia saying, "God is going to get you, little sister," after she showed dismay when he announced he had a date with a new woman on October 4th, the anniversary of when he shot Harriet Robinson. James Alexander chose to drop the charges in 1986, insisting it had been blown out of proportion. But it did not matter. John Alexander had violated the terms of his parole by stopping his medication, so he did go back to prison. But in 1995, he was up for parole again. And as the Clarion Ledger put it, that created an unlikely alliance between the surviving Robinsons and John Alexander's own family. His sister Patricia recalled the 1986 incident before the parole board, intimating that her family had been so afraid that they had checked into a local motel until he went back to prison. In 1995, Patricia Alexander, now a lawyer herself, said, quote, "Should John Alexander ever be released from prison for any reason whatsoever, I will live in terror for my life and the lives of others. John will kill again." John Robinson III, also now a lawyer, said, quote, "If there's ever been a case where someone should remain in prison, it is this." John Alexander's new attorney said that he had been unlawfully imprisoned since 1986 when his parole had been revoked. It was now up to the Supreme Court, but they sided with the Circuit Court and kept John in prison. They reasoned that the simple assault charge and the stopping of his medication was sufficient for the revocation of his parole. But John Alexander wasn't finished. He has filed for parole many times in the years since and has always been denied. In 2013 and 2016, he managed to publish ads in the Northside Sun newspaper out of Jackson. The 2013 ad quoted Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice and also yammered on about how he had supposedly kept his mouth shut and taken his punishment. He said the citizens of Mississippi were predominantly Christian and forgiving. In 2016, he quoted Shakespeare again in the Northside Sun, with the quote, "Earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice." He then wrote extensively about his mental health diagnosis, but insisted that for the last 26 years he had been on medication and should be released. These newspaper ads did nothing to persuade the public to his side, and honestly, they show him to be as mentally ill as ever. His last appeal was in March of 2019, where the court rebuked him for filing a frivolous writ of habeas corpus with his own brief, wasting the court's time. He was warned that future frivolous filings would result in monetary sanctions and restrictions on filing any other post-conviction reliefs. It's pretty damned clear that the state of Mississippi has no plans to ever let John Alexander out of prison again. From prison, he's trying to change his name to John Apple and has a website that says it's under construction. Unfortunately, I do believe John Alexander is exactly where he should be. He is a danger to himself and others, and he does receive his medication in Parchman. It is up to you, listeners, if you believe he was insane when he shot Harriet Robinson. I tend to agree with the prosecution psychiatrists. There were more doctors than just Dr. Pollack who had deemed him sane at the time of the murder before those damning letters were read aloud in court. He bought a gun and waited, hoping to happen upon Harriet Robinson, or maybe even John Robinson. But I think it's clear from those letters that he had focused his vengeance on his former lover and not her husband. Perhaps he played tennis that morning with his friend at Battlefield Park, hoping to run into her. I think she was avoiding the Jackson Country Club because of the scandal, and he knew it. But she wasn't at Battlefield. She was at the Parham courts. So after his own tennis match, he calmly drove home, changed clothes, and then waited until she walked out into the parking lot after her own tennis match and shot her in cold blood in front of numerous bystanders as her children were playing at a nearby playground. I do believe he knew right from wrong at the time he killed Harriet Robinson. He is now a sick old man, housed at the East Mississippi Correctional Center, still trying to get out of prison and change his name. He is now 65 years old and really has no hope of getting out. I'm going to quote Simon and Garfunkel again. Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. You did not deserve that brutal death because of one mistake. A mistake so many people make. I hope she, her husband, and daughter are all at peace now, and that her other children are leading happy lives. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Riles McWilliams for suggesting this fascinating case. Today's episode is dedicated to my mother, Lisa, who passed away on December 8th after a sudden illness. Not only was she my number one fan, she gave me my love of true crime. She would let me watch made-for-TV movies based on true crime, and we would be sure to watch the end credits to see if the movie was based on a book. And then she would take me to find the book, scouring used bookstores if we had to. She also instilled in me the love of reading. She didn't care what I read as long as I was reading. She didn't judge. She didn't care if I read V.C. Andrews or Stephen King, even when I was really young. She just loved that I loved to read. And you don't become a writer without first being a reader. I owe that to her. And she was very proud of me and this podcast. For that, I am so grateful. But it kills me that she didn't get to hear this episode. There is a TV movie loosely based on this case, starring Susan Lucci, that I tried desperately to find when she was in the hospital so we could watch it together. She loved Susan Lucci and was often accused of naming me Erica after her character on All My Children. She didn't. It's a family name. But it became a funny family joke. She had wanted to name my sister Abby, but didn't because, as she infamously said, she didn't want people to think she named her girls after the two worst bitches on television. Abby was a character on Knott's Landing, and my mother was a hoot. Listeners, if you can find that Susan Lucci movie, I would still love to watch it while drinking a glass of wine and toasting to my mother. It's called Between Love and Hate. Shoot me an email if you can find it. And I wish you all a safe and happy holiday season. I'll be back on January 10th. Until then, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.